it's interesting with him that he really does, I think, use this as you said, as a salve to appease some of his own guilt and to justify his actions, I think, more to himself than to anybody else, because guilt is such a common theme throughout his book, and he refuses to take any sort of personal responsibility for it, even though his reactions to a lot of Serenice's questions indicate that he, on a subconscious level at least, understands that he did something wrong and that he needs to be held accountable and responsible, and does hold guilt regardless of whether he directly killed people or not. And what's interesting is at the very end of the book, Serenae basically talks about how in her last interview with him, he finally admits that he was guilty and he did have a role in the system and he was responsible for these deaths, at least in part, even if he never personally killed anybody. And he dies of a heart attack that within 24 hours.
Welcome to Activist NNT, a podcast about real-world economics, including modern money theory, and how life changes when you discover it. I'm your host, Jeff Epstein. Today's part two of a three-part conversation with historian, author, and Harvard Master's graduate Emily Rule on her new paper, In League with the Divine, How Religion Influenced Nazi Perpetrators of the Holocaust. You will find my detailed question list at the bottom of the show notes for part one, and also be sure to see the list of audio chapters in all three parts to find exactly where each topic is discussed. A full introduction can be found at the beginning of part one. But for now, let's get right back to my conversation with Emily Rule. Enjoy.
That is deeply tied to what I mentioned before, the idea of a Führer cult, this idea that you are going to do whatever your Führer tells you, regardless of whether or not you think it's correct. And then the Weltanschauung is really just a term for all of these things together. It's the Nazi worldview of what they think the world should look like, how it should be constructed, and what they are really striving for and striving to create, not only in Germany, but as they expand throughout Europe and presumably, if Hitler had his way, eventually throughout the world. And that includes all of these things. So it includes the Volksgemeinschaft, it includes anti-Semitism, it includes Blut und Boden. So it's really just the culmination of all of these things together.
Okay. There's a concept that I don't have my head around, but I know that there's something there. And that is this idea of racial purity, of racism, that there are races at all, that it's like, you know, our Aryan, German Aryan is pure and everything else is not, whatever. You know, maybe arguably crudely that works for, let's say, 90% of the cases. Like, it's easy to tell. Like, this person's Aryan, this person's not Aryan. They're black, they're whatever. But on those edge cases, on those 10%, it's difficult to tell. Number one, people intermix. Mm-hmm. Number two, you know, sometimes people just look different, whatever. And it's like, there's confusion among that remaining 10%. And that confusion, I think, in some way, my instinct strongly says that somehow kind of spreads like a disease to basically make the entire theory fall apart. That it you know, it's impossible to, there's no definitive boundary to that theory because it's a bogus theory. There's no scientific, there's no biological, whatever, to the concept of race. Mm-hmm. So it kind of falls apart in that way. So I don't know. It's just.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I 100% agree. And I think the Nazis were very aware of that because they went to great lengths to try to avoid their theories, their racial theories, from falling apart in any way. They, you know, constructed entire course curricula in schools to try to teach children how to identify people as, you know, Jewish in particular, and how to identify them as not Jewish. You had, you know, math problems that would be created that, you know, even if you couldn't necessarily target somebody based on racial qualities, you could target them on other factors. So there were math problems that were included in math textbooks that children use that would, you know, ask them to calculate the economic drain on Germany that was caused by, you know, people with physical and mental disabilities who were institutionalized in hospitals. And then they would have to argue why it basically, in essence, they were arguing, you know, and trying to find evidence to promote the idea of euthanasia. And there are blood charts that you can actually find where they do go down all the way to like the 10% of, well, okay, if your great-great-grandparents were Jewish, you have this percent of Jewish blood, are you Jewish? So there were actual charts that the Nazis constructed to try to figure out what to do with these people who are not, you know, maybe they don't even know that they're Jewish because it's so far back in their lineage, and then trying to calculate basically if they have a certain percentage of blood that would classify them in turn as Jewish. So again, like you said, it's completely bogus theory, but the Nazis, I think, were very aware of that and went to great lengths to try to prevent their theories from just collapsing.
And it killing people, I think, was the only way for that to not fall apart, is they had to kill those edge cases. They had to kill the people that were in any way questionable in order for the 90, you know, the 90% to become the 100%, basically. Mm-hmm. So anyway. All right. Okay. On page one of your introduction, you introduced someone named Franz Stangl.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a police superintendent at the Euthanasia Institute at Hartheim.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
That's an institute. Okay. So this person explained how he only shot children who were motherless. And he said that, quote, it was soothing to my conscience to release children unable to live without their mothers. And as you point out, the word release has religious undertones, that it means redeem or to save. And therefore, his killing the child made him a savior or a redeemer in the eyes of God. And what I found just fascinating and shocking was that he only killed the children after their mothers were first killed by one of his comrades.
Mm-hmm.
So if you kill a child and then his mother, that's murder. But if you kill a mother and then the child, that's a mercy, an act of mercy sanctioned by God. Just mm-hmm. Reversing the order in which you murder people changes it from immoral to sanctioned by God.
Mm-hmm.
So, please.
Yeah, no, so actually the person who was discussing this that with his comrade that, you know, he would only kill the child after the mother had been killed. That's actually one of the members of Police Battalion 101. His name is Friedrich. We don't know his last name. He was obviously this member of this police battalion, this kind of makeshift Einsatzgruppe in mobile killing unit. And yeah, he recounts very, very clearly in some of his source material that he made certain that he was not killing any of the children prior to their mothers being killed, because he felt that by killing the child, it was an act of mercy, because they were now, if their mother was killed, this child was now motherless and would perceivably have no way of surviving in the world. So it was basically an act of mercy to kill these children. And he does use the word Erlösen, which in German, you know, has somewhat religious connotations if you look at it within a religious context. It's this idea on the front it just means to release. So he's saying, you know, I'm releasing these children from life. But really, if you look at it then within a religious context, it has the definition changes and it means to save or to redeem. So he's now taking on a religious quality. And again, it goes back to bias of, well, did he actually mean to use it in the religious context? Did he mean to use it just in the normal phraseology that it means to release this person from life? We can't really be sure, but it is interesting to note that there is a religious connotation to this word in German that has very spiritual connections and implies that by killing this child, he's acting on the part of the divine, that maybe he himself is embodying elements of the divine. Because typically when you talk about being a savior or redeemer, we think of like Christ or we think of God. So he's kind of elevating himself in that sense through the use of this word to divine status by killing these children.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So this person, Stengel, also talks about how the Catholic clergy advocated for this so-called mercy killing of the motherless child that, you know, he made motherless. And he said in a 1971 interview, quote, "Here was a Catholic nun, a mother superior, and a priest, and they thought it was right. Who was I then to doubt what was being done?" So religion had two sides to it. Number one was to justify doing horrible things. But number two, I think, you know, very important, was also a salve, an excuse, a way for people to be okay with it, to justify, to come to terms with the horrible things that they did. So if you do what, you know, the horrible things we want you to do, the Nazi Party, what we want you to do, here's your built-in excuse for maintaining your sanity for the rest of your life. So can you talk about both sides of that? Religion was, number one, a tool to coerce, and number two was, I don't know a better term for it, but a salve, an excuse, a justification, once they did what they were coerced to do.
Yeah, I think so. I think I'll talk about the salve first, because it's interesting with Stengel that that's something that's very clear when you read his interview with Gita Sereny. He is sentenced to prison. He goes on the run after the fall of Nazi Germany, ends up in South America, and is later found by Nazi hunters, brought to trial, and is sentenced to prison. So she's interviewing him in prison. And I believe it's about 3 decades after the end of the Nazi regime. So it's not immediately after, but he very clearly recalls this idea that, you know, when he's visiting Hartheim, and he goes in and he sees this child who is, you know, looks very young, is kind of curled up in on himself and can't really, based on looking at him, can't really care for himself because he is very severely disabled. And Stengel is in discussions with this mother superior and a priest who are there, and they basically say, oh, well, this child isn't actually, you know, super young, he's actually 17 years old and obviously will never be able to take care of himself. And their quote does say, like, you know, that basically they're promoting euthanasia of this child. And Stengel does, you know, he recounts this story, and Sereny basically asks him, well, didn't you see something wrong with this? And that's when he responds with that, well, you know, there was a priest and a mother superior and they thought it was okay. And who was I then to question this? So he's turning to the authority of the church to really justify the idea of euthanasia and the fact that he is actually involved in the process. He holds more of an administrative role, so he's never directly involved in any of the euthanasia that happens, but he is still involved in the system, so he does still hold accountability. It's also interesting to note that he has differing views of what his role is than other people do. So he says that his job was to go around and collect all of the all of the items that of people who were euthanized and to then return them to the families. Whereas other people who worked with him said, no, that wasn't his job. It was just administrative. He had no reason to be going to Hartheim in the first place. So it's interesting to note that there are these discrepancies. It's also interesting to note that Stengel himself basically states that he was never overtly religious. He was religious to a point in that he was born and basically told, I believe he's actually Catholic, and basically told that he is Catholic, but he doesn't attend church on a regular basis or anything like that. So he doesn't consider himself religious by nature, and yet he's turning to the church, to this institution that is supposed to represent high moral standards, and saying, well, they're approving euthanasia, so somehow that eliminates any guilt from me, because if they're saying it's right, it must be right. And so what I'm doing can't be wrong, and what I'm involved in can't be wrong. And it's interesting with him that he really does, I think, use this as you said, as a salve to appease some of his own guilt and to justify his actions, I think, more to himself than to anybody else, because guilt is such a common theme throughout his book, and he refuses to take any sort of personal responsibility for it, even though his reactions to a lot of Serenice's questions indicate that he, on a subconscious level at least, understands that he did something wrong and that he needs to be held accountable and responsible, and does hold guilt regardless of whether he directly killed people or not. And what's interesting is at the very end of the book, Serenice basically talks about how in her last interview with him, he finally admits that he was guilty and he did have a role in the system, and he was responsible for these deaths, at least in part, even if he never personally killed anybody. And he dies of a heart attack that within 24 hours. So take for that what you will, but I think that that's just an interesting connection. And I'm sorry, what was the first part of your question? I went off on a tangent.
That it's coercion. That's coercion. And that it's also the salve once you do what you're coerced to do.
Oh, yes. So the coercion part, again, it's very difficult to see just how coerced, especially people in religion, really felt in Nazi Germany, because the Nazis never really do what they say they're going to do, per se, especially as it relates to religion. So, you know, the promises, as we've already discussed, the promises to protect the Catholic Church and then still attacking the Catholic Church, or being more pro-Protestant but still trying to find ways to eliminate Protestantism as it exists in Germany at the time, having their own pseudo-religious beliefs that they're trying to force upon everyone. So it's really hard to know, in the case of the priest and the mother superior, for instance, if they felt like they had to say these things, because Stengel is a member of the party. He is, to a point, he's kind of high ranking, at least in the system of euthanasia, because he is in the administrative status. So did they feel coerced to say that, to go along with euthanasia? And more broadly, did other such individuals feel coerced into having to go along with, you know, as we grow into systematized imprisoning and extermination with death camps and things like that? It's really hard to know. And in the case of the priest and the mother superior that Stengel talks to, we don't have their side of the story. We don't have any documents from them that we can learn anything from. I don't even think we actually even know who they are, because Stengel himself does not give an identity to either one of them beyond them being members of the clergy. So unfortunately, we can't know for sure. But again, you know, the Catholic Church was never necessarily under any threat of being completely eradicated in Germany. Protestant opposition was just as severe. And there's also, what's also important to note is that there was never any documentation that if you refuse to go along with it, especially for people who were involved in the military, involved in death camps, involved in euthanasia centers, there was never any documented case that if somebody refused to kill Jews, to kill people who were disabled, to kill whoever it was they were told they had to kill, that there was ever any punishment for it. And in fact, in Christopher Browning's book, there is a member of Police Battalion 101 who tells his commanding officer he cannot shoot these people. And the only thing the commanding officer does is give him a different assignment that is not, that does not involve killing people. So there's never any documented case that there would have been punishment, that there would have been repercussions. So again, this idea of coercion is very, very difficult to determine.
Okay. All right. So next question, and this is the first question where, you know, a long time ago, I mean, it's not a year, but it's definitely been like at least like 10 months or something that, you know, I first found out about your paper and I started thinking about connections between our two kind of interests where, you know, false religion was used as justification for committing genocide. Mm-hmm. And my interest is that false economics is used as justification for mass austerity and exploitation, which is really just a more indirect and slow motion genocide. And so so this question is the first one where I think kind of spans both of those things. And that is, all right, so we just talked about religion being a form of coercion and then being the salve when you, being the justification or the salve when you do that, what you're coerced to do. And so building on that and also returning to biases in primary sources, the biggest bias as I see it is power. It is required to say that killing the unworthy is necessary and that it is commanded by God. Because if you don't, then you become worthy of being killed yourself. Mm-hmm. If you don't stand with the party, then you are against the party, and then therefore you become unworthy yourself. And that you have to say that someone is unworthy, or at least don't interfere with someone who is saying that. You know, like there's a story about a wife in your paper about how the wife wasn't, you know, a virulent racist, but she didn't say anything while her husband was murdering people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, passive. So this is true for average people all the way through the highest levels in both religion and government, that they have to at least passively support this pseudo-religion of anti-Semitism and anti, you know, anyone who's not Aryan. So how much, you kind of addressed this, but how much did that clergy that Stengel mentioned really believe what they were saying, and how much of it was that they were simply trying to protect themselves and the church from being destroyed by the Nazi party? How threatened did that clergy feel? So in other words, the fact that Stengel felt permission from the clergy, as I see it, is really just his being, number one, coerced by religion. Mm-hmm. Because in turn, those religious figures were coerced by the Nazi party. Because they had to accept that they signed that treaty where they had to accept the Nazi party as a legitimate government. And the Nazi party was primarily for erasing non-Aryans from the earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's an excellent point, because actually one of the arguments that the Vatican makes of why they don't necessarily intervene once they have evidence that the Holocaust is happening is that they are very reluctant to kind of step in and to in any way undermine Hitler's government, because there is this agreement. There is a fear that Hitler will destroy the church if, you know, if the Vatican breaks their agreement, then Hitler will have no reason not to break his agreement. So again, it's really hard, because you do have to look for bias, obviously, and this does tie in closely with, you know, just how threatened people really did feel, if the things they're saying, if they actually did feel as threatened as they feel, or conversely, if they felt threatened and only claimed that they did not, to try to save face or to try to align themselves more with the Nazis and to show support to the Nazis. So it is very hard. And it's very hard, especially to determine, because we are dealing with a dictatorship that, you know, is killing opposition, which is generally how dictatorships function anyway. But, you know, it kind of goes back to what I was saying. You know, it's the Catholic Church, I think, recognized that even if they were not destroyed entirely, that there were attacks that were being made. So I think to a certain extent, Catholic clergy definitely felt like they had to abide by what the Nazis were saying. In some cases, you do have clergy members who do speak out against the regime. And that's the case for Catholics. It's the case for Protestants. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, again, being kind of the prime example of this, of somebody who very openly criticized the Nazi regime, attacked the Nazi regime, actually was involved in the plot to assassinate Hitler in 1944, and was also one of the few people to very adamantly speak out against Nazi anti-Semitism. So I think it's kind of, in a way, connected to going back to that man from Police Battalion 101 who said, "I can't shoot these people." I think there was fear. That was a very real fear for many people, especially members of the clergy, members of the church, even the Vatican, even though they're not stationed in Germany, they're still, you know, they're controlling Catholicism throughout the world. So this is a very real concern, something they need to address. I think there is fear that if Catholics in any way oppose the regime, then attacks against Catholics will worsen. So I think that is a very real fear. But it's also important to note that other people felt the same, even if they weren't Catholic. They felt that if they spoke out, there would be repercussions. Stengel himself actually says as much. He says, well, if I didn't accept this position, then my family would have been killed. Or if I didn't do this, then there would have been repercussions. I didn't know where my family was. How was I supposed to know if they were still alive? Things like that. So whether or not there was actually any belief in this, I think fear is a huge component when we get into right-wing politics, into governments, into dictatorships. They function largely on fear and on establishing fear in the populace that opposition will result in repercussions, serious repercussions for yourself or for your family, for friends. So you can't discount that that existed in Nazi Germany. But it is important to take into account the fact that there were people who spoke out regardless of the repercussions. Bonhoeffer himself is arrested in 1943, and he's questioned by the Gestapo, and he's later executed actually a month before the war ends. So he, you know, obviously does face repercussions, and that's a very clear example of a member of the church who, I mean, even though he was Protestant, he spoke out. Member of the clergy who is, you know, targeted and arrested and killed for speaking out against the regime. But then on the other hand, you have these other people, like the man who was in Police Battalion 101, who says, no, I can't kill these people, and nothing happens to him. So I think it depended on how, like, the level at which you spoke out. For the guy in Police Battalion 101, he, you know, it was just his action. He was just like, I can't kill these people. And it was really only affecting him. He was replaced by someone else who was more than happy to go and kill these people he had been assigned to kill. But for people like Bonhoeffer, I mean, he is very public in opposing the regime. And so that is viewed as a much greater threat by the Nazis. So I think had individual clergy members maybe just on the down low been less supportive of the regime, not quite sure if anything too drastic would have happened, but I think there was a real fear that anything could have been viewed, especially for Catholics, as being public denouncing of the Nazis and would have faced repercussions. I think that answers your question.
Yeah, I mean, you say there's no punishment, and I think the answer is that there was not punishment for that person.
Yes.
But, you know, on the there's a lot of micro examples that there was no punishment for standing up, but those people did not threaten the regime.
Correct.
They you know, the, you said, you know, attempting to assassinate Hitler, that was the threat to the regime. Mm-hmm. And I think that the fact that there was no evidence of no punishment on these kind of small examples is really just another example of the Nazi Party tolerating some level of protest, mm-hmm. as long as it didn't threaten their power, in the same way that they tolerated religion at the beginning, because,
yeah, exactly.
Okay, so the next question, I'm kind of mixing a little bit compared to what I prepared, but so I want to religious symbols. So there's religious symbols like architecture and clothing and belt buckles and pins, and that, you know, again, the party did not want to originally be religious, but these symbols are very religious from both pagan and Christian. And actually, just to quickly define, as far as I understand, paganism is not a religion in and of itself. It's rather just not Christianity. Mm-hmm. It's just if you're not Christian, you're pagan. That's basically as I understand it. And there's an equivalent term in economics, which is called heterodox, which is basically not mainstream. So it's kind of the absence of equality as opposed to equality itself. Another symbol, religious symbol, was the white outfits. It wasn't like the clothing and the belt buckles and so on were like deliberately created stuff. The white outfits that were worn, especially by concentration camp doctors, mm-hmm. and then, you know, secondarily later on by commandants of concentration camps, that came from something that already existed. The white outfits of doctors was like, you know, a common thing, mm-hmm. that wasn't just created. That became a symbol. So can you talk about these religious symbols and their significance and some examples or whatever of both the white outfits and all of the other stuff like architecture
I'll start with the doctor's coat, since that was what you left off on. The doctor's coat was interesting because that does exist. I mean, it's a common symbol of the medical profession, that somebody is a doctor. And that's the case today. It was the case just as much in the 1940s. But what's interesting is that the first doctor's coats were chosen to be white in part to represent that the person themselves, that they were basically clean, that they, you know, physically clean, that they were healthy. So kind of this epitome of what we think of as doctors, of people who are very sterile and clean and won't necessarily, you know, contaminate their patients with germs and, you know, blood from the last operation they did, things like that. But it also was chosen because of the color white's ties to ideas of moral purity as well. So there was this idea that doctors were supposed to be physically clean, but also that they were supposed to be morally clean and morally upright. And so when you look at this moral component to the white coats, it takes an interesting spin, because there are doctors who are present in concentration camps and death camps who are wearing these, and you can assume that yes, they are wearing it because they are doctors and that is a sign of their profession. But then there are other people who are physicians but are in these camps who without that role. They are in these camps as, for instance, a camp commandant. So Imfried Eberl is a great example of this. He was a Nazi physician, but he was sent to Treblinka when it first opened to be the camp's commandant. He was not a physician there, and yet he would stroll around camp in his doctor's coat. And what's interesting is that he was not, either by choice or just by nature, was not good at management and did not have a system for getting rid of the corpses that were in Treblinka. And so Treblinka was filled with corpses that were lying around everywhere. And he was seen by many people on many occasions walking around the camp among these corpses in his white doctor's coat that he really had no purpose to be wearing. And what's interesting is when you look at it as the white coat representing moral purity. There's this idea that perhaps Eberl, to some extent, was wearing that to try to portray himself as being morally upright, that the things he was doing was morally upright. But it's also a reflection of omnipotence. And many doctors reported, or at least you can tell from their writings, that they developed some sort of feeling of omnipotence because they were in charge of human life in so many respects, whether they were responsible for selections that were made in death camps, where they literally decided in a split second just by looking at people who lived and who died. They were in many cases, you know, put in positions where they were able to exact inhuman treatment on people. You can look at, for two examples, Hermann van Mueller, who was he was involved in the euthanasia program, and he chose to starve children as his way of euthanizing them. And then, of course, you have Josef Mengele in Auschwitz, who is very infamous for a variety of reasons, but also, you know, perhaps most significantly for his medical experimentation. So there are these ways that doctors had control over human life, not just in deciding who lives and who dies, but in how they controlled those who were determined to live, or having control over how those people lived or how they died. And so there's this sense almost of having this almost divine power over human life. And even that, in some cases, that doctors reported feeling almost as though they had been sent by God to do the work that they were doing, because they viewed their role, especially if they were very aligned with Nazi anti-Semitism and Nazi racial beliefs, they felt that their role as doctors, specifically as Nazi doctors, was to heal the German folk. So again, back to that Volksgemeinschaft, this idea that there were these racial impurities in the German community that needed to be eradicated in order to save, in order to heal the German populace, and that it was their role to do that, to heal the German folk by getting rid of these malignities that they viewed, these racial malignities, through, in this case, extermination. So that's very interesting with doctors, but they were not the only ones who actually were white, which is interesting. You do have, as you mentioned, the camp commandants, not all of them, but some of them. Franz Stangl actually is one of them, who has a white uniform specifically designed just for him. Like, it's an entirely white uniform. And there was absolutely no reason for it. And Sereny kind of really questions him on this white uniform and on why he was really only ever seen wearing it when he would attend these selections and the unloading of new transports in Sobibor, when he was commandant of that camp. And his response is very lackadaisical. He just says, oh, well, it was hot out that day. But so it's very ridiculous. And Sereny kind of calls him out on that, like, that's a ridiculous response. Like, you really are not grasping this. But he very much tries to dodge the question. And I think, again, because there is this understanding that white symbolizes not only moral purity, but also, when you look at it from a religious stance and a religious lens, white is commonly associated with heavenly bodies, whether that is God, whether that is Christ, whether that is angels. There is this kind of heavenly connotation based in religion that is associated with white. And that ties in very closely with the adamant belief that camp commandants had, that they had executive authority over everything in their control. Everything in the camp, and specifically the lives of the prisoners in the camp. So that meant that they had control over all judicial matters, all legislative matters, all executive matters, including the lives and deaths of the people who were there. So this idea that Stengel is showing up and is overlooking all of these new unloading of transports and is watching as doctors are making their selections of who lives and who dies, and he's standing there looking out over all of this, observing it in this white uniform, gives him a very divine persona, almost, of him, you know, being in charge of and overseeing kind of the playing out of life and death in his camp. And Fritz Gebauer, who is commandant of Yanov, does something very similar. He actually wears his white uniform leading parades to places where prisoners are to be executed. So both of them use white in very similar ways to try to kind of reflect what they think is their internalized divine status. I believe your other question was about the insignia and the pins and things like that. What's interesting is that you have these white uniforms that are very linked to Christian ideas. And then you have insignia that in some cases, yes, are linked to Christian ideas, like the belt buckles saying, you know, basically that God is with us, that were worn by SS guards in camps. But you also have a lot of pagan ideas that start to come into the insignia. So you're right, paganism really can be looked at as being just not Christian. But for the Nazis in particular, paganism is what they see as being the religion of the ancient Germanic peoples and the traditions and the beliefs that those people had, because the Nazis have this desire to return to what they think is a true Germany. And so paganism, which is, again, is very interesting because it, in some ways it's very accepted by the regime and in others it's very not accepted by the regime. But Heinrich Himmler, who is in charge of the Schutzstaffel, the SS, he kind of starts this transition into paganism and becomes a very ardent paganist. And so he starts imbuing the SS with all of these different runes and runic symbols that he thinks is somehow reestablishing a connection between the members of the SS and the deities that were worshipped by these ancient Germans.
I believe the SS symbol itself, right?
Yes, the SS symbol itself, those two lightning bolts. Yep. Yeah. He can actually be linked to a certain extent to, for instance, you know, the lightning bolts of Thor, going back to Nordic traditions. So the SS, you're correct, themselves are two lightning bolts. So that in itself is a runic symbol. But he also incorporated other runes, such as not only runic letters, but also the Totenkopf, which is the death's head. So it's actually the skull and crossbones that we know very famously. Those would be engraved on rings that were meant for elite members of the SS. Members of the death head units would actually wear the Totenkopf on their caps or on other parts of their uniforms. And these symbols kind of served multiple purposes. The first was that Himmler really did see these as a reflection of ancient German traditions. He believed, as many Nazis who were proponents of paganism did, that these symbols were somehow mystically imbued with the beliefs of ancient Germanic peoples. And so Himmler felt that by physically putting these runic symbols somehow on the bodies of the members of the SS, that it was in turn imbuing these individuals with that mystic will and that mysticism and the divine status that he felt kind of went along with that. In turn, it also, again, kind of served that dual purpose of justification, of morally justifying themselves, of saying, okay, well, we're wearing these runes, and that means that we are somehow in line with the divine, and committing these crimes, if we're in line with the divine, then these crimes that we're committing must be okay, because we're doing it on behalf of the deities. So there is, to a certain extent, moral justification. There's also, very interestingly, a component of baptismal effects, in essence. Himmler believed that runes and the Totenkopf and other symbols like the black sun, he thought that they had some sort of ability to renew the spirit and to kind of give rebirth to people if they were surrounded by them or if they wore them. And so by giving his troops these symbols, he was also, in essence, baptizing them into this new kind of Nazi pseudo-religion that they were creating, which is bizarre to think about, but very interesting.
Okay, and just a final comment regarding symbols is that, like, clothing, the white outfits, the belt buckles, the pins, and so on, like, you have to choose to put them on, and it's only with you. But there's also architecture where, mm-hmm. number one, that's not just with individual people. It's whoever in the building, and also, yeah, and whoever sees the building, for even from a distance. And it's also like the much more permanent. It's much more long lasting, because mm-hmm. even when people die, their pins are, you know, generally are in a drawer somewhere or whatever, but the architecture lives on. So I just wanted to say that part.
I can comment on that if you want me to. If not, yeah.
If you have something to say, go for it.
Yeah. I mean, Himmler does, there are two instances. So one, he actually repurposes a castle, Wewelsburg Castle, to become this SS headquarters in essence, and repurposes a lot of the castle, puts runes in certain rooms so that, you know, they can serve as worship rooms. He fills libraries, like personal libraries, especially of the officers, with books that are promoting notions of paganism, and really just restructures this castle to become what he thinks is the headquarters of what he sees as modern crusaders, these SS units. But then you also have the Nazis actually creating their own architecture to symbolize religious notions. One of the most obvious is the Ehrentempel, which were designed to house the 16 Nazis who had died in the beer hall putsch in 1923. And so the Ehrentempel are designed almost with a dual purpose. In one way, they are very similar to the pyramids of Egypt, which also held religious significance. They served as a place where you were entombing, literally in sarcophagi too, because these 16 members are entombed in individual sarcophagi, 8 in each of the two Ehrentempel. And so you have these structures that are designed and built to entomb people who are considered to be very high ranking, very high status, just as you have, you know, pharaohs who are entombed in Egypt. And what's interesting is these were not leaders at the time. They were just members of the Nazi party who were killed that day, but because they were killed in the putsch, they are now elevated to this very high political and even military status. The buildings also are designed to represent the Parthenon. They actually look identical to the Parthenon in many respects. And the Parthenon, you know, having been a structure dedicated for worship and prayer to the goddess Athena, who was the patron goddess of Athens, in a way, if you look at these two structures as being replicas to a certain extent of the Parthenon, because that was the way they were designed, it's the way they were built, you're in turn implying that these are now not only high-ranking members of the Nazi society and the Nazi regime, but that to a certain extent, they're now seen as kind of these patron saints of the city and of Nazi Germany, because the Nazis wanted people to go there and to pay their respects to these people, to invoke their spirits, to, you know, give this idea of sacrifice, and especially sacrifice for the common good and for the Führer, to anybody who visited these temples. And so they were designed to a certain extent for religious purposes, even if it wasn't necessarily to a god or a deity, it was to, you know, pseudo deities that the Nazis had created of these dead putsch members. And what's interesting is that, because you did mention, you know, architecture lives on, like it's permanent. And I think because of the significance of these things, it's one of the reasons that the Ehrentempel are actually one of the structures that the Allies blow up at the end of the war. And so they actually no longer remain. I think parts of their foundation are still there, but the Allies blow them up in 1945.
Okay. Okay. So regarding the doctors and how the white coats made them, you know, basically gods and commandants secondarily, there's a quote that I want to say, which is, there's a book called Modernity and the Holocaust. I have not read it, but it's by Zygmunt Bauman that was told to me. Quote, It was not illiterate savages, but graduates of the finest educational systems of the West who designed the gas chambers used to burn millions of innocent men, women, and children in Germany. So regarding these, a little bit related to these symbols, is that how there are different levels. Like, commandants decided who should be killed, but mostly didn't do it themselves. Doctors decided who should be killed and did it themselves, and they also followed the orders of the commandants. And then there's soldiers who did a lot of the killing, but they didn't decide who to kill, mostly. Mm-hmm. So can you just talk about these different levels of people in the Nazi Party? And
and I think it's interesting too that with these different levels of people, the symbolism that they either chose or had imbued upon them really reflected their level in the hierarchy and their level of involvement in happening.
And actually, like the soldiers, these symbols, these physical symbols, were like, you know, the doctors wore the coats, the commandants sometimes wore the coats, whatever. Mm-hmm. But the soldiers had the belt buckles, mm-hmm. you know, and it's just kind of, and the pin, I guess, pins and whatever, but like the belt buckles, like these symbols were given to them or with them in some way.
Yeah. And it's really, I think you hit the nail on the head there with saying that they were given to them. You really have, if you envision like these doctors and these commandants who have the authority over who's living, who's dying, and even within that context, how people are going to die or how they in turn, how they are going to live. If they're going to be, you know, for instance, if they're going to be experimented on, in the case of Mengele and Auschwitz. So you have these people who have this authority and they have this control, and in some cases are involved in the killing process, because you do have people who are experimented on who do die from the experimentation. So Mengele is responsible directly for the deaths of some of these people. So in some cases, they are directly involved. They have almost this divine status. So I talked a little bit about how doctors felt they had omnipotence, commandants felt they had executive authority, and so they almost take on the persona of gods on earth, in essence, that they are these individuals with divine status, with control over everything that's happening in their territory, including life and death. And then you have... And in many cases, that is self-fashioned. So you have people like Ebrel who are choosing to wear their coats. They don't have to. They are making that decision. And then you have Stangl, who is creating his own white uniform. So they're creating things to give themselves this physical persona that matches the way that they are assumably seeing themselves. But then you do have the kind of rank and file members, the guards.
Today's part two of a three-part conversation with historian, author, and Harvard Master's graduate Emily Rule on her new paper, In League with the Divine, How Religion Influenced Nazi Perpetrators of the Holocaust. You will find my detailed question list at the bottom of the show notes for part one, and also be sure to see the list of audio chapters in all three parts to find exactly where each topic is discussed. A full introduction can be found at the beginning of part one. But for now, let's get right back to my conversation with Emily Rule. Enjoy.